Okay, if you'd like to take a seat, I think we'll think about making a start. We may get a few other people drifting in if they get bored of other people, or equally, you may drift out if you get bored of us, but it's a free world. Let's start with prayer, and then we'll get into it. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the opportunity to be here in Chopron and for all the resources you have on offer for us, all the things we can learn. And I pray this afternoon, Father, that as we look at this vitally important topic about history and these two great faiths, Father, our own and that of Islam, Father, help us really get into the subject, understand the issues, and I pray that we'd come away confident of the way that you and your revelation does stand up to history and that Islam has huge questions to answer. And I pray that we wouldn't just learn to be able to go away with that, Father, but we'd learn to be able to go away and apply it to the Muslims we meet and the context we operate. Ask that in your name. Amen. The format, the way that this afternoon's going to work is similar to yesterday afternoon. A few of you came to that. I'm going to speak for the first half. Jay's going to speak for the second. We'll have questions after I've spoken, if you have any. And then we'll have some more time for questions after Jay's spoken. And then at the end, kind of questions for kind of both of us. And what we're hoping is that our presentations are going to sort of dovetail. I'm going to be looking at the historical Jesus. And you may wonder, actually, some of the stuff you listen to when I'm doing it, what on earth does it have to do with Islam? Because we're going to be in the New Testament period. Really, what we're doing is a contrast. Really, we hope you come away going, gosh, the historical work that's been done in the New Testament area, it's actually very affirming. There's all kinds of things we can learn. The historical work that's been done in the Islamics area, my word, aren't there questions. So really what we're doing this afternoon is comparing two methods. So keep that always in your head as we go through things this afternoon. We're looking at two methods as we look at the historical Jesus versus the historical Muhammad. As I say, that's what we're looking at. That's where we're going. The aim of this workshop is to compare the historical Jesus with the historical Muhammad. And the first thing really I want to address at this point is something that comes up when we talk about the historical Jesus, and it's the question really, what do we mean by the term historical? In New Testament studies there's been an awful lot of talk about the historical Jesus. We're now seeing it in Islamics, talk about the historical Muhammad. What do we mean by that? Well, the answer is up there on the PowerPoint for you. By historical, what we mean is simply the facts that we can ascertain using the critical tools and methodology of the historian. Now, it may be that in the case of Jesus, that doesn't get us all the way to a fully blown divine Christology and atonement, all that kind of stuff. That's not a problem. It's not saying that we can't have that. It's simply saying, well, how far can we get? Let's see how far we can go if we use historical tools. And let's ask the same of Muhammad and of Islam. So I'm going to be concentrating on Jesus, and we'll be looking a little bit about the Jesus of Islam at the end of it, and then Jay later on will go on and we'll look a bit more at the Islamic side of things. But let's start appropriately with a history lesson, since we're looking at the historical Jesus and what we mean by that and what's gone on to date. And basically in New Testament studies there's been a lot of talk about the quest for the historical Jesus, and in fact scholars would speak of three quests for the historical Jesus that have taken place in New Testament studies in about the last sort of 400 years. And let's begin with the first quest. Now, if we look back to the very late 17th, early 18th, and on into the 19th century, as the Enlightenment project worked itself out in every field of knowledge, scholars began turning a critical eye to the New Testament. They began asking critical questions. It really all kicked off with a guy called Reimerus, who was a German scholar, and basically the approach that rapidly gained ground was to consider that the Gospels were products of faith and not products of history. They were pious constructs of faith with not a lot of historical weight behind them. And because this was true, so the argument went, there was a need to rediscover the Jesus of history. You know, the Gospels gave us the Jesus of faith. What was the real historical Jesus actually like? And the following century saw a plethora of liberal lives of Jesus. Everybody going wrote a life of Jesus, sort of setting out what the real Palestinian Jewish Jesus was like. Often he wasn't very Palestinian, not very Jewish. But that was the trend. They were all over the place. The quest for the historical Jesus, as the scholar Albert Schweitzer was to famously term it, had begun. And in fact, Schweitzer, his name is down there on the bottom, wrote a book called The Quest of the Historical Jesus. And he and another scholar, Weiss, were actually more or less responsible for demolishing that whole approach to Jesus, because they showed beyond a doubt that what you got on those liberal lives of Jesus was those scholars taking their own ideas and projecting them back to the first century. And there's a famous line, not actually from either of those, but from another scholar, about what these guys saw when they stared down the well of history was a liberal Protestant face reflected at them back from the bottom. They saw their own, they recast Jesus in their own image. So devastating was the critique of the first quest that for 50 years, not a lot happened. New Testament scholarship thought, we can't do history, it's dead, it's a disaster, let's not go there. But in 1953, a chap called Ernst Cussermann gave a very, very famous lecture in New Testament studies in 1953. And what he argued was this. He argued, well, hang on a moment. We don't have to throw out the historical baby with the bathwater. We can actually hold together history and faith. Maybe the Gospels contain both history and faith. And what we really need are critical tools, careful critical tools to weigh them up. We need to be able to look at each verse of the Gospels and say, is this history or is it faith? And if we do that, then we can produce a historical Jesus. And now there were problems here too, because the Jesus many of these methods produced and the scholars in the Second Quest produced, again, wasn't very Jewish. He looked very un-Jewish, very un-sort of first century, really, because the tools, I think, were very much in their infancy. And again, there was a lot of scepticism and a lot of kind of feeling, particularly in kind of evangelical circles, that history was a bad thing. Protestants and evangelicals in particular tended to retreat into a kind of ghetto, really, and go, history, don't even go there. Let's just stick to faith, because history is full of skeptics. But we live in an exciting new age, really. We live now in a time that's been coined by N.T. Wright, who's a New Testament scholar, currently Bishop of Durham, the Third Quest. Things have changed very much in the landscape of New Testament studies since the 1960s, as a whole new approach has come to light, mainly because of a huge range of new discoveries about first century Judaism, or Second Temple Judaism, as it's called in scholarship. Basically, what we have is a whole range of new sources, and sources that are taken a lot more seriously for the period, that enable us to get into and dig into the background behind Jesus. The most famous are the Dead Sea Scrolls, discovered in 1947, but really scholarly work only really got going on those in the 60s and 70s. Josephus, the Jewish historian Josephus, known about for ages, but tended to be left on the side. The intertestamental literature, Jewish apocryphal books written between the Old and New Testament, actually tell us an awful lot about the Judaism of the period, the kind of people who wrote them. In short, a huge amount of resources for the first century. These sources are major assets and can tell us an awful lot about the Judaism of the day and the kind of Judaism in which Jesus found himself. Now, the availability of sources, we would have to say, is a major contrast with Muhammad and with Islam. We'll see this when we get to Jay and his side of things. Basically, there are no contemporary primary sources, really, for the pre-Islamic Arabia in which Muhammad was born and lived and grew up. For the rise of Islam, we have very, very few scattered references to the rise of Islam. Everything we have there is from much later Muslim sources. We don't have contemporary sources. Jay will unpack that in a lot of detail. So basically, when it comes to Jesus, we are way ahead of the game in New Testament scholarship compared to my colleagues working in kind of just in the Islamic area. It's really, really hard if you want to try and do Islamic history or Islamic prehistory, because there ain't anything to go on, and hence scholars tend to wildly conjecture. So the question is, having got all this, what does it actually tell us? What can the Third Quest for the historical Jesus actually help us with? Now, let's remember, we're engaged in historical questions. We're asking, what can we learn using history and to see how we get? Well, one important question that the Third Quest can help us with, and where a lot of effort has been concentrated, is this. The question of Jesus and Messiahship. This has been an amazing battleground in New Testament scholarship over the years. A huge debate is, did Jesus think he was the Messiah? A lot of scholars saying no, other scholars saying yes. If he did, what kind of Messiah? And so on and so forth. A huge battleground in New Testament scholarship. And there are a lot of issues lying behind this, not least the fact that there is a disparity between the use of the term Messiah, the Greek term there is Christos in the New Testament. In the Gospels, hardly ever occurs on the lips of Jesus. This was something that the no camp tended to point to. The yes camp can point to the fact that earliest Christianity was a messianic sect. Everywhere you look in early Christianity, Jesus is affirmed as being the Messiah. How do you hold those two tensions together? The Third Quest has done an awful lot of work in this area. We're going to go into this in just a moment. And generally, there are skeptics working in this field of scholarship as well, but generally, the Third Quest has eroded skepticism. There's a lot more positivity around the New Testament studies today than there was even 20 or 30 years ago. A lot more scholars prepared to say, yes, we think Jesus did understand himself to be Messiah. Maybe he tried to reshape what that term meant, but nevertheless, yes, he did, and we think we can show that. So what we can do, and what the third quest is concerned to do primarily, is to begin here, is to begin by locating Jesus on the map of first century Judaism. Using those sources we talked about earlier, we can draw, if you like, a map of first century Judaism, the kind of things that were believed, the kind of practices that went on, and we can try and locate Jesus upon that map. There's two thoughts driving this. One is that Jesus' thought patterns were shaped by his context. Jesus was incarnated as a first century Jew, so it's probably likely that he thought to a large degree like a first century Jew, otherwise it makes a bit of a mockery of that doctrine. And furthermore, he had to be understandable to those he spoke to. He was popular. When he spoke, people listened. He drew crowds. People came and heard him. He clearly was able to scratch where they were itching. So it's important, therefore, to look at how he fitted onto the map of Judaism. How would people have understood the kind of things he was saying? And third quest work has shed an awful lot of light on the first century Jewish background, on a whole number of things, on the politics, religious and secular. First century Palestine was an extremely complex area. You had religious politics, the Pharisees and the Sadducees battling it out. You had the Romans there trying to assert influence. You have the sociological makeup of first century Palestine, huge disparities between rich and poor. You have the competing religious groups, Pharisees, Sadducees, we've mentioned. The Essenes were a Jewish kind of esoteric group, lived out in the desert, had nothing to do with anybody else. There's the question of the way that the Jews had adapted to life under Roman rule. The Jews were living under oppression, and one of the things they had to do in the first century was theologize that, work out how is it possible to be a Jew and believe all the things that God had promised you, yet still have Caesar crashing down and putting you under his boot. And so a lot of Jewish texts from the period are very concerned with answering that question. As we look into those, we get an awful lot of background for Jesus. And occasionally, in fact very often, things that Jesus says and the way people react to him, you begin to see more light on them in the light of what's going on in the context. So the question I guess we want to ask is, in this context, against this background, what did messiahship mean in this kind of historical setting? What did it mean? Well, the prominent model was royal Davidic messiahship. That was the prominent model of messiahship. There are plenty of other groups in the first century, plenty of other messianic figures in the first century, in the period, in the years around it. Groups of people turning up and going, yes, I'm the Messiah, or more commonly their groups and their disciples going, yes, this guy's the Messiah. Often the model was royal Davidic messiahship, looking back to David and all the glories of that time of Israeli history. But other models did exist. Priest, prophet. We often hear in Christian circles the little formula, don't we? Prophet, priest and king. Well, that was quite alive and kicking in the first century. Our friends out at Qumran, the Essenes, quirky as ever, believed in two messiahs. Two for the price of one, is the way I sort of tend to think of it. A priestly one and a kingly one. Basically, everybody tended to believe something different. And N.T. Wright, again, New Testament scholar, has said this nice little line. Messiahship was, it seems, whatever people made of it. It was a stretchy kind of concept, messiahship in the first century. You could play with it. Your group could believe different things, yet sort of shoehorn those into the term messiah. But the crucial thing is this, though. Messianic beliefs, whatever shape they took, were eschatological beliefs. They were first and foremost about the restoration of Israel as the people of God. The new age that texts like Isaiah 40 to 55 speak about, of Yahweh coming and acting on behalf of his people to restore and redeem them, those were kind of key texts in the period, and those were the kind of texts and ideas that messianic language tapped into. If you spoke in messianic terms, you were saying, we believe that Yahweh is going to act to bring about his promises. He's going to sort out the fact the Romans are over us and change things and turn them around. So the question I guess we need to ask when we look at Jesus and messiahship is, did Jesus work with this theme of Yahweh coming to restore and rescue his people? Was that an issue for Jesus, or is it something he couldn't be bothered about? Well, the answer is that he seems to have done, because the way that scholarship has generally answered this question is by looking at the kingdom of God theme. You only have to read Jesus' parables or teaching in the Gospels, particularly in the Synoptic Gospels, and you see the phrase the kingdom of God turns up everywhere, 52 times in the Gospels, and Matthew prefers to render it the kingdom of heaven. If you include that, 82 times, almost all of Jesus' parables, concern this kind of idea of the reign of God. There's been another big battle in New Testament scholarship around this theme, mainly as to the question, did Jesus see the kingdom as future, something would happen, way, way, way up in history, and it would eventually get there, or was it present? Was it happening there and then, in the midst of his ministry? And basically, scholarship in New Testament circles at the moment has arrived at something extremely rare in theological circles. It's arrived at consensus. And the consensus seems to be that the kingdom was both. Jesus believed that the kingdom of God was breaking into history, is a phrase you hear a lot of scholars talking about, in his ministry, crashing into history and beginning to come to bear, and would then come in full force later. Inaugurated eschatology, if you're a theological student, you can sort of throw that around and makes it sound like you know what you're talking about. But that's vital, because when you look at the background against which Jesus is operating, that Jesus saw the kingdom as breaking into history in some way through his ministry is nothing short of staggering when you look at it against the background context, when you look at it against the first century background. Because people like Isaiah and people like the writer of the Psalms of Solomon, which is a text from the period, they could all speak about the kingdom of God. They could all look forward to Yahweh acting on behalf of his people, but they were looking forward. They saw it as something way, way, way down the future. Whereas Jesus could say, you know, blessed are those who've looked forward to this thing, but your eyes have seen it. This is happening now in my ministry. This is absolutely dramatic. And even skeptical New Testament scholars have a problem with this kind of language with Jesus, because it does look like Jesus is definitely sort of saying and implying that all these things that were long hoped for are coming true now. Now, we've looked at the preaching of Jesus, the kingdom of God, but this theme works its way out as well when it's we turn to Jesus' miracles, which are inseparably bound up, I would argue, with his preaching of the kingdom of God. And I think it was precisely through his miracles and his works of power that the inbreaking kingdom of God, the present aspect of the kingdom coming into history, was witnessed. That's clearly seen in Matthew 11, 2 and 6. That's a double tradition passage in which it's the story when John, who's in prison, sends his disciples to Jesus, if you remember the story, to ask him, are you the promised one or the one who is to come? It's fascinating. You have John is obviously having some kind of doubts. And the answer Jesus gives is not, yes, I'm the Messiah, go and tell them that. He says, the blind walk, the lepers are healed, the prisoners are set free. Jesus quotes from Isaiah, particularly Isaiah 61. He also quotes from that when he's preaching in the synagogue in Nazareth in Luke 4. And basically Isaiah is talking there about the kind of things that will happen when the Messiah comes, the kind of deeds that will follow it. Jesus is able to quote that and go, I'm doing that now, and sends John's disciples back to him to answer that question. Again, if you know the context of that, the background context, the kind of text that were read in the period, you realise how dramatic that is. There's one text in particular that we don't have time to read in full detail now. All of this information, all of this paper is up on the internet, like we talked about yesterday. We'll give you the website address again at the end. But very briefly, this is a text called 4Q521. That's the number that scholars give to it, from the Dead Sea Scrolls, and a text from about the period. And it's talking about the kind of things that the Messiah will do. And it's fascinating if you read sort of halfway down, it says, for he, that's the Messiah, will honour the pious upon the throne of eternal kingdom, freeing prisoners, giving sight to the blind, straightening out the twisted. He'll heal the wounded and will make the dead live. He'll proclaim good news to the poor. This should sound familiar. Jews in the first century context in which Jesus was operating knew their scriptures. They knew what Isaiah talked about, and they knew the kind of things that when the Messiah came would start to take place to show that God's kingdom was coming to bear. When you look at Jesus' words in the light of that, you realise, good grief, no wonder people took him messianically. Think of when he feeds the 5,000, John says. The people tried to grab him and make him king. They knew full well these kind of background. They knew the kind of thing that Jesus was revealing himself to be. So no wonder that there'd be messianic conclusions drawn. Now, we'll also have a very quick look at exorcisms, which is the other kind of work of power that Jesus did. Jesus has a reputation as a miracle worker and as an exorcist. And he directly connects in Matthew 12:28 and Luke 11:20. He directly connects the coming of the kingdom with his exorcisms. The Lucan version of that says, if I by the finger of God cast out demons, the kingdom of God has come upon you. And basically, you know, very, very important text there. Now, in the first century, Satan and his minions were considered responsible for sickness. In Second Temple Judaism, there's a number of texts where that's very clear, that Satan was considered responsible. So when Jesus also carries on healing, as well as engaged in exorcisms, there's plenty of Jewish exorcists from the period. They tended to just cast out demons. Jesus cast out demons and heals, demonstrating to his audience, to those watching him, that actually he's plundering Satan's domain. Again, first century Jewish texts from the period speak of the kind of things that will go on when God's kingdom will come. And one of the hopes that is witnessed is that Satan's kingdom will fall. There will be no sickness and death. And again, we see Jesus operating in this kind of background. There's a little quote there from a New Testament scholar called Graham Twelvetree, who says that Jesus did not believe that his exorcisms showed the kingdom coming. Rather, they were the kingdom coming. if you were a Jew and you were sick or you were possessed in the first century, well, what would it mean for God's kingdom to come? It would mean that you would be set free. Finally, then, we're getting towards the Quranic part of this. Third Quest scholars have increasingly recognised that to understand Jesus fully, you need to understand that he had a vision for the nation of Israel. He wasn't just about preaching and healing people and doing all kinds of that stuff. He was also about politics, just as John the Baptist was before him, if you look at kind of John's ministry. Jesus has already drawn upon, as we've seen, Isaiah 40 to 55, and the kind of great sermon there from the prophet Isaiah as to what Yahweh will do for his people Israel when his kingdom comes in power. That's a national hope. Messiahship was very much a national hope before it was anything else. And now in many strands of Second Temple Jewish thought, if you go and read the text from the period, it's crystal clear that Yahweh is going to act. He's going to act to redeem his people. That was believed. And it was believed he would do that through some kind of eschatological messianic figure. That is all over the place. That language is everywhere. That's the map that Jesus is operating on. There are other clues in Jesus' ministry that show he's operating on this kind of map. One of the ones that a lot of scholars have got increasingly excited about, there have been a couple of quite significant works done on it, is his choosing of the 12. Jesus appoints 12 symbolic new leaders. Symbolic leaders, arguably, of a new restored Israel. Jesus didn't pick 12 accidentally. If you were a Jew, you'd known full well what Jesus was doing when he picked these guys. In short, Jesus demonstrated that the kingdom of God was coming in and through his ministry. He demonstrated its presence with signs and wonders, displayed a concern with the restoration of Israel, and draws upon Second Temple themes, like Jewish themes like Isaiah 40 to 55, and themes that are all over the texts from the period. Particularly when we look at Jesus against the historical background, we see all that in even sharper focus. If we had more time, we could look at other evidences. We could look at Jesus' messianic entry into Jerusalem. We could look at the trial scene. It's very interesting in the trial scene that Caiaphas, shortly after the cleansing of the temple incident, one of the first things he says to Jesus is, "Are you the Messiah?" Because there were texts from the period, ideas from the period, that the Messiah would come and rule over the temple. Caiaphas knows his texts, and the trial goes directly from questions about the temple to questions about messiahship. Again, if you know your history, if you know the first century background, that all becomes so much clearer. So, that's where we've gone. It's a very, very rushed summary of some of the work that's going on in New Testament scholarship. But I said that the key thing today is methodology. And I wanted to think very briefly about what we've done in the last 15 minutes. And then in the last 5 or 6 minutes, we're going to go and look at the Jesus of Islam as a contrast. What we've done is this. We've explored a historical approach to Jesus using some of the available sources from the period, always comparing Jesus to the background against which he was operating, rather than assuming he was operating in a vacuum. And when you do that, you discover that the world painted by the Gospels is very, very accurate. The kind of things that the Gospels portray going on, a lot of the kind of sectarian tensions and battles that Jesus faced, the way that people reacted to him, highly accurate when we know what's going on in the period. In fact, the Jesus revealed by the Gospels, I would argue, is demonstrably a first century Jew, and he fits his context like a glove. He doesn't sort of glaringly stand out. He looks like he would fit as a Jew of the first century, the kind of things he was doing and the way he was operating. None of that should come as any shock to us. And the Jesus of history, I would argue, to put quote marks around that, the Jesus of history fits very well, I think, with the Jesus of faith. Like I said at the beginning, it doesn't get us all the way there, but I don't think there's a glaring clash. As evangelicals, we do not need to run away from history. The New Testament scholar James Dunn talks about a kind of flight from history in evangelicalism. We don't need to do that. We can embrace history and go, yeah, it gets us an awful long way. It may not get us all the way, but we don't need it to. But it's interesting how far it can get us, how much it can reveal. So the question is then, what about Jesus in the Quran? So we look to Jesus in the New Testament. Jesus also appears in the Quran, as I'm sure you know. He appears in about 90 verses in the Quran. And it's a fairly skewed presentation. It's a fairly short presentation. The story of Jesus in the Quran really starts actually with Mary's story. The Quran is very, very interested in the story of the Annunciation to Mary. It appears twice and in quite great detail. The birth of Jesus is told again in great in reasonable detail. A lot of detail in the Quran that doesn't occur in the Gospels, but occurs in apocryphal Christian sources, like Jesus speaking from the cradle. Infancy miracles occur. One is that one. Jesus turns clay birds into living birds in the Quran. In fact, the Quran is generally interested in miracles as a whole. There's very little information about Jesus' ministry, but miracle lists appear on several occasions. It says that he healed people, he turned birds into clay birds, he brought to life, he did X, he did Y. Jesus faces opposition in the Quran from the Jews, of course. If you know your Quran, you'll know that. So they're a popular kind of opponent in the Quran. Well, Jesus faces opposition from the Jews who try and crucify him. But of course, in the Quranic understanding of things, Jesus wasn't crucified. Allah vindicated him, raised him up. And in popular Muslim thinking, someone else was put on the cross in Jesus' place. And the Quran, I would argue, is arguably more concerned with asserting right belief about Jesus than it is about kind of narrative. Really, it's concerned about, you know, asserting that we Christians have got it wrong, that he's just a prophet, he's just a human being, just a servant of Allah, and rather than telling the story. So hence, the Quranic presentation is fairly skewed. But the interesting thing is this, the crucial thing, in fact, I would say, in the light of where we're going today, is to notice that there's a complete absence of any of the Jewish theology or Jewish background thinking that we saw in the case of Jesus in the Gospels. He preaches and uses the kind of themes that we know are going on in the period. Jesus was scratching where people are itching, saying the kind of things that he knew would get a reaction and a response. None of that in the Quran. No background theology at all. No sense that Jesus actually was a Jew. I have Muslim friends who say, of course Jesus wasn't a Jew, but he don't be so stupid, he was a Muslim, which sort of tells you everything, really. No hint of the first century context. I think this is highly significant. Jesus isn't connected with Bethlehem, Jerusalem, Nazareth, Galilee. No mention of the political groups, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Romans. None of that kind of stuff going on at all there. In fact, the reason is fairly straightforward. And the reason is this. The Jesus of the Quran serves an entirely different function within the Quran. He's not there as a kind of historical figure or any of that. He is there for a purely different purpose. And the purpose, very simply, is this. He's designed to be relativized, first of all. He's placed very firmly in the Quranic line of prophets. He's played down his role, minimalized, and mainly because, of course, if you want to assert the superiority of Islam, then, of course, the Christians have to be taken down a peg or two. And one way the Quran does that is to relativize the person of Jesus. Secondly, he's made a forerunner to Muhammad. That's very, very clear in the Quran. Jesus is quite clearly nothing more than a forerunner to Muhammad. And I would argue the Quranic Jesus is intended to legitimate the prophethood of Muhammad. The Quran basically wants to show that all the kind of things that Jesus did, that Muhammad did rather, Jesus did before him. Muhammad wasn't innovating, he was simply copying Jesus in the prophetic line. There's a little table here just to give you a few of the examples. Jesus on the left from the Quran, Muhammad on the right. Jesus is called Nabi, Rasul, prophet and messenger, Abd, slave. Slave of Allah. Muhammad, exactly the same titles. Jesus gets the Injil and the Quran. Muhammad gets the Quran. Jesus declares some formerly forbidden things permissible according to the Quran. Lo and behold, Muhammad does exactly the same. Jesus performs two of the pillars, Zakat and Salat. Muhammad does exactly the same. The disciples of Jesus, they're called Muslims. Disciples of Muhammad, lo and behold, they're called Muslims. The Quran is very concerned to show, look, Muhammad is just following in the line of Jesus. He's not innovating. He's not making this up. He's a good prophet, like we've seen in the prophetic line. Furthermore, the Jesus of the Quran is largely defined in reaction to the Christians of the day. Hence those apocryphal stories we talked about, Jesus making clay birds come to life. We know from the background, the 7th century background in pre-Islamic Arabia, that was a story that appears to be well known in the Syriac Christianity of the day. It's fascinating. It turns up in the Quran, and it turns up in the Quran really to put a Quranic spin on it. It's yes, Jesus did that, but it was purely by Allah's permission. He didn't do it because he was God or divine. He did it because he was a prophet, and it was a sign. Lots of those kind of examples in the Quran. Jesus being contrasted against the background of the Christians of the day and used as a polemical example. This is a Muslim scholar here based at currently at Oxford University. Has written a book on the Muslim Jesus, and he says this. The Quranic Jesus is, in fact, an argument addressed to his wayward followers. He's not a historical figure or any of that. The Quran has turned him into an argument. Fascinating that Khalidi, who's obviously a more liberal end of Muslim scholarship, is quite prepared to admit that the Jesus of the Quran isn't historical. He's very open about that. The net result of all this is to entirely divorce Jesus from his first century Jewish context. He's in his context in the Gospels. We come to the Quran, he is removed. So we can conclude, before I hand over to Jay, and we'll do a bit more of the Muslim side of things. The Jesus of the Gospels, then, I would argue, is a historically viable presentation. He fits the first century context. The work that's been done in New Testament scholarship to date and is going on today shows that again and again and again. Yes, there are questions. There always are in these kind of disciplines. But the main thing is Jesus fits the landscape of first century Judaism extremely well. And that's very, very encouraging. We have a wealth of primary sources to use in that research, the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Old Testament, for example, is a very important source, interestingly enough, in New Testament scholarship, because, of course, every Jew believed it. But the Quran is entirely ignorant of this first century context. Entirely ignorant. As I say, no place names, no names mentioned, none of the politics, nothing. You wouldn't know, reading the Quran, that Jesus ever went to Jerusalem, let alone kind of, you know, ministered in Palestine. That information is, you know, just one example of the kind of way that it's relativized. And the key thing that the Quran does do is it relocates Jesus to the 7th century. Jesus becomes an Arab Muslim. He lives in the way that Muhammad does, because that's the only model that Muhammad knew. And so that's the model that's projected on to Jesus. So we're going to hand over to Jay now and look at the more of the Islamic side of things. But to remind you, particularly those of you who weren't here yesterday, the paper that I'm presenting and Jay's material is up on the internet. Well, will be up on the internet from the end of next week as a PDF. So don't worry about trying to scribble quotes down too much or anything today. If you miss anything, it will be there from the end of next week. While Jay's setting up, does anyone have any questions on where we've gone in the last kind of 35 minutes? Yes, I mean, I think I'd love to have done a section on why Jesus was crucified, because that's obviously a battleground in New Testament scholarship and a very important area, but I kind of figured we couldn't shoehorn it. I mean, I suppose in an absolute nutshell, I think here the historical thing is very, very interesting as well, because for me Jesus was crucified by two parties, by the Jews and by the Romans, and for very good historical reasons. From a Jewish perspective, he was a false prophet, he was leading Israel astray, he was getting a following. And there was a very delicate power balance between the Jews and the Romans in the first century, particularly in Jerusalem. The ruling group, the Sadducees and the high priestly family, only ruled by the only power they had, of course, was by the generosity of the Romans. They were allowed so much power, and their job, basically, the reason they were there, was to ensure peace. If there was any trouble in Jerusalem of the first century, the Romans came down like a ton of bricks. And in fact, if you were one of the aristocracy, you could lose your life, because the only reason you had any power was to keep a lid on the Jews, who were known. Absolutely, and the crucial thing with the Romans, what did the Jewish leaders do when they hand Jesus over to Pilate? Well, he's a troublemaker. He's a messianic, you know, he's a messianic pretender. You know, he's claiming to be king. And so, of course, Pilate, who we also know from historical documents of the period, was not a very good leader, and actually gets removed later on. So again, the last thing Pilate wants, and the last thing the Jews want, is trouble. Because in the years immediately before Jesus, there had been riots around Passover time. And what happened? Well, the Roman armies came in, and hundreds of Jews were killed in the forecourts of the temple. So that's very much in the background. So a similar thing goes on. If you know the background, you begin to go, you can see why Caiaphas acts the way he does, and Pilate acts the way he does. There are good historical motives there, and I think yes, it's fascinating. Anybody else? Or if not, what we can do is say after Jay's gone, we can fire questions at him or me, or kind of both of us, really, as our methods fit together.
Okay, we're going to switch gears now, and we're going to go to Muhammad. We're going to talk about we're going to do three things with Muhammad. We're going to look at the historical Muhammad, and this is taken from two papers that I've done, which will be up on that site that you saw, that will be up there next week. One of the papers has been highly controversial, and I've been banned from UCL and from Oxford because of that paper. I've been unbanned, by the way, so I'm back in there again, because the administration found out that almost everything I said in those papers, you'll see, is sourced in their traditions. And if they're going to ban me, they have to ban their traditions. But it's been highly influential. We've had a number of Muslims that have given their lives to the Lord because of this material on Muhammad. It's an area of study that Muslims don't want to talk about, and you'll see why as we go through it. The problem, obviously, for Muslims is their authority rests on the Quran and on Muhammad. Those are the two paradigms. Those are the two pillars that hold up Islam. And if you start criticizing Muhammad, immediately you're going to get a reaction. If those of you have had this chance, if you do it in a public context, we do it all the time at Speaker's Corner, and if you even begin a criticism of Muhammad, you're going to get a very violent, many times, certainly a very hostile reaction. Be careful when you use this material. Don't use it lightly. It's not to be used willingly. Be careful. Use it in the context of somebody you have a relationship with. But the historical Muhammad is a whole discussion that's come out primarily out of England. And it's come out because of the classical model of Muhammad. Now, we haven't really given you the classical model of Muhammad, but what we do know and what the Muslims will tell us, let me use the laser here, is that he was born in 570. He received his revelations in 610. Those of you who were here yesterday, remember Keith talked about that, in the Hira cave. And then he moved up with his followers 12 years later in 622 to Medina. And when he moved to Medina, that's when the Islamic State came into being. That's when much of the last 10 years of his revelation started. And in 624, he had his Mi'aj, when he was taken up by the winged horse to Jerusalem and went up to the seven heavens. He received his revelation from God that he was to pray five times a day. Came down to the fifth heaven, and back and forth between Moses and God, he brought it back down to five prayers. It's a great story that you can read in the traditions. That's when the Salat then was canonized. I'm saying that purposely, and also when the Qibla was canonized. So that's important because we'll talk about that later. And then, of course, his revelations from 622 up until 632 were much more referred and geared much towards what was happening in his life in those last 10 years. He died then in 632. The Quran had not been written down. And according to Muslims today, it was finally then written down during the time of Uthman in 650. Now, we could go into a whole lot more about Muhammad's life. You can read a biography. There's lots of biographies out there. You can read, and certainly you can find them. The good ones, probably the best one is Bell's or Guillaume. Guillaume, G-U-I-L-L-A-U-M-E. It's probably the best one to read because he goes right to Ibn Hisham, and he writes the biography written by Ibn Hisham. But everything that I've just said in the last 5 minutes about Muhammad's life, about everything that happened back here, when do you think it was written down? Any ideas off the top of your head? Or when would you like it to be written down? I mean, I should start with that. When would you hope it was written down? Okay, within a century. How about the rest of you? Do you agree with that? No? But when would you like it to be written down? If you're a good Muslim, when would you want it to be written down?
By him, by the guy before he died.
Yes, by his companions, by people who were right there, by eyewitnesses. That's why it's so important when we look at the life of Jesus and you look at the gospel accounts. At least we have three eyewitnesses there, one who got it from the others and even says so and admits that. It's very important when you do a comparison. We would want the same thing for Muhammad. And certainly we would ask that there should be some documentation that we could look at that comes from that time period. Because you're talking about the 7th century here. This is very late. There's no reason not to have documentation from the 7th century. That's just 1,400 years ago. By the 4th century, you have documentation. You certainly have parchment. You have vellum. We can go to the British Library and see the entire New Testament right there in London from the 4th century. The Sinaiticus that we see in the Ridback Gallery, and right next to it, the Alexandrinus from the 5th century. We've got about 230 documents of the New Testament from before the 6th century. So certainly by the 7th century, they should not have had any excuse not to have this biography written down, right? You would expect that. But the earliest we have of any biography comes from this man here, Ibn Hisham. We don't even have his documents, in fact. He died in 76-5. Ibn Ishaq. And it was his students, Ibn Hisham, that actually wrote it down first. And he died in 833. Ibn Hisham is the first documentation we have on Muhammad's life. Now, take a look at the gap there, 200 years. That's a big gap. If you want to talk about the sayings of the prophet, and here's the other problems, because the sayings are much more ponderous, they're certainly a lot more prolific. The sayings of the prophet, the hadith, as we know them, were first tabulated by this man, al-Bukhari. And look at his date, 870. If you want to talk about the tafsir, which are the commentaries on how to explain and understand the Quran, you need to go to al-Tabari. He was the first one to write the tafsir down. If you want to talk about the tahriq, which would be the histories concerning all of mankind, from creation right up to the time of Muhammad, you've got to go to al-Tabari, because that's the first time any histories were written down. That's the 10th century. He died in 923. So everything we know about the Prophet's life, about what he did, what happened, that initial part of Islam, how it was being formed, what was going on, the battles, everything that happened surrounding his relationship with his wives, you name it, all that material, which did take place here, doesn't get written down till here and here in the 9th and 10th century, 200 to 300 years later. Men like Michael Cooker, who's out of School of Oriental and African Studies, are looking at this, and they're the ones who are coming up and they're saying, hold on a minute, why is it written so late? And why is there no documentation earlier than that? Now, that's a perfectly valid question, isn't it? It's a question I would ask as a historian, and we should be asking it, and certainly we are asking it. The Sira, Ibn Hisham, the Hadith, Bukhari, Mishkat al-Masabi, which is the six compilations that were put together, or the six most authoritative compilations, they don't get written, put together until the 14th century. Tabari, who is writing Tariq and the Tafsir. Now, there are many that come after Tabari. You have Baliduri, you have Zamakhshari, you have Al-Siyuti, you have Baidawi. All of these are writing after the 10th century. Look at their dates. Go ahead. We're not talking about the Quran now. We're talking about the tradition surrounding Muhammad. We'll do the Quran tomorrow. Okay? Wait for the Quran. We're not talking about the Quran now. These are just the traditions. But see, the traditions is where we get the life of the Prophet from. The traditions is where we get his sayings from. The traditions is where we get, really, and we're going to get to that tomorrow, when the Quran was written. Because the traditions tell us and give us a date for the Quran as well. And that's very disturbing. And it's very disturbing because that's the second pillar. But we'll hold on till tomorrow with that question. Right now, we're just going to stick with the Prophet's life because that's what we're looking at. We want to know, when did the Prophet live? When did he do all these things? How do we know all of these things happened? And of course, we know that none of it is primary. It's all secondary sources. In fact, you're basically talking about 200 years of oral tradition that they're dependent on. 200 years to 300 years of oral tradition at a time period where there's no reason for oral tradition. All right? Can you get that at least? If the knowledge of the life of Muhammad was transmitted orally for a century before it was reduced to writing, then the chances are that the material we have undergone has undergone considerable alteration in the process. Therefore, Cook went to the Greek, Syriac, Armenian sources from the 7th and 8th century. Basically what Michael Cook did, along with Dr. Patricia Krone, both of them are from School of Oriental African Studies. Cook now is at Princeton University. Krone was head of department at Oxford University. Then she moved to Cambridge when I got to know her. She was my supervisor beginning my doctorate. Dr. Patricia Krone from Denmark. These two then decided, because of the fact that these are all so late, let's go back to the 7th century and let's find out what happened, which is perfectly legitimate. As a historian, you need to do that. If these are all so late, 200 to 300 years later, it stands to reason. I want to know what's going on in the 7th century because people were writing down what was happening to them. They were being conquered by these Arabs. And they were writing as to what was going on. And the conclusion they came up with is that the history of Islam, including the life of Muhammad, and up to at least the time of the Caliph Abd al-Malik, that's the Sufyanic, the Marwanid Caliph, from 685 to 705, is a later fabrication. Much of it has been fabricated. We'll get into that. So, John Wansbrough, who is considered to be the father of revisionism, of Orientalist revisionism, this new school that's coming out questioning the authenticity not only of the Quran, which we're going to talk about tomorrow, but also the whole premise of who Muhammad was, what happened, how Islam began, the whole emergence of Islam in the 7th century. John Wansbrough wrote two studies, Quranic Studies in the Sectary Milieu, in 1977 and 1978, and he just blew this whole thing open. And he was head of department at School of Oriental and African Studies in the University of London. It was Cook and Krohn, who were his students at that time, that then took his theories and ran with it. And, of course, John Wansbrough had a death threat on his head, and he had a fatwa by the Muslims when he wrote these books. Highly damaging books. Basically, he was just asking simple historical questions. The compilers took their material from collections compiled between the decades of around 800, not from the 7th century, and not from Muhammad, is what they're finding. Believe that both the Quran, in his book of sectarian milieu, came out of sectarian controversies, and therefore the Quran, as we're going to see tomorrow, was more a composite that evolved not over a period of 23 years, like Muslims like to tell us, but, as we're going to find tomorrow, over a period of 100 to 150 years. Highly damaging. The Maghazi documents are the section of the Sira, Maghazi, they're called it. They're the section of the biography of Muhammad, written by, first compiled by Ibn Hisham in 833, which are the earliest, according to historians, the earliest part of the Sira documents, which talk basically about the Prophet's life. I'm sorry, his battles and his campaigns. They don't say much about him as a prophet. In fact, there's no reference at all to a veneration of Muhammad as a prophet in the Maghazi documents. Now, that's curious. This idea of his prophethood comes much later. in the documents, not in the earliest ones. Now, let's move on. There are many contradictions. Al-Tabari, when he recounts all the references to the Prophet's life, finds huge amounts of contradiction. And one of the things that you have to love about Al-Tabari is he writes them all down. He doesn't take an opinion. He just says, so-and-so says this, so-and-so says that. It doesn't make sense. Wait, I don't know which one I believe, but they're all there for you to take your pick. And he's doing this in the 10th century. Now, Muslims today are not reading Al-Tabari. And they need to go back and they need to start questioning what's going on here and exactly what kernel of truth. I'll just give you one example here. This is a reference to Muhammad meeting a religious man. And there are 15 different references. This comes out of Corona's Cook material. One reference says that it was during his infancy. Others said it was when he was 9 or when he was 12 or when he was 25. It was an Ethiopian Christian, or maybe it was a Jew, or maybe it was a seer, maybe it was a kahin, which would be the storytellers, or possibly it was at Mecca, or perhaps it could have been at Ukaz or Dhul Majaz. So these are all different references about the same occurrence, different places, different times, different ages. Which is the correct one? We don't know. Tabari doesn't help us. So what's happening here? Obviously, these are just amalgamations of different oral traditions have been written down in the 10th century, referring to what was happening, supposedly, in the 7th century. Quran therefore concludes that what we have here is nothing more than 15 equally fictitious versions of an event that never took place. There's a huge proliferation. Let me give you an example. Ibn Ishaq, who was writing just before 765 when he died, refers to the fact that Muhammad had a father named Abdullah. And all we know is the fact that Abdullah died before he was born. And his mother died when he was 6 years old. That's all we know from Ibn Ishaq about this man named Abdullah, slave of God. Waqidi, who's writing 50 years later and is one of his students, suddenly tells us that Abdullah, when he died, how he died, where he died, what his age was, and exactly what place of his burial. Where did Waqidi get all this information from? Obviously, as Cook says, what we're finding out here, this evolution in the course of a half a century from uncertainty to a profusion of precise details suggests that a fair amount of what Waqidi knew was not knowledge. He was creating it as he went on. Bukhari is another case in point. Bukhari, who is the one who was given the responsibility to put together the hadith, the sayings of the Prophet, in around 850 to 870, so the 9th century, mid-9th century, was given 600,000 akhbar, 600,000 sayings of the Prophet. He looked at these 600,000 sayings, eradicated through almost 95% out, and was only retained 7,397 of them. Out of the 600,000, that's all he retained. When you look at these 7,000 and you put them together, you'll find only 2,000 of them are actually unique. There are many of them are repetitions. Can you see what's going on here? And the question we need to ask is, where did those 600,000 come from and where did they go? And how do we know that any of the 600,000 were authentic? Well, then you need to go to the isnad. What Muslims will tell you is the way we know they're authentic is the list of names. Isnad. In every akhbar, you have the matan and you have the isnad. I'm sorry, you have the isnad and the matan. The isnad are the list of names that give you authority for each one of the matan, which is actually the reference, the statement. And isnad basically says, I've got it from so-and-so, who got it from so-and-so, who got it from so-and-so, who got it from the companion of the Prophet. And this is a whole science of isnad in Islamic jurisprudence. Names of transmitters, isnad. Yet there's no documentation for any of these isnads prior to the 9th century. The prophetic authority begins basically around 820. And suddenly, from 820 on, all the isnads trace their way back to Muhammad. Whereas before 820, they went back sometimes to the companion of the Prophet. Sometimes they'd only go back to the late 7th century. Sometimes as late as the early 8th century. There's a problem here. And then in 820, Shafi, who is the founder of the Shafi school of Islamic law, fiqh, this delineates that every isnad must trace its place right back to the Prophet himself. Based on oral tradition, and the difficulty is obviously when you look at the life of the Prophet, when you look at the Sira Maghazi documents, when you look at the Sira of Ibn Hisham, you will see there's a huge amount of embellishment. Muhammad is perfect in every category. He's the perfect father, the perfect husband, the perfect lover, the perfect warrior, the perfect... In every category, he is perfect. There is nothing. There are no imperfections. Obviously, showing that there's been an embellishment. Well, that's what happens with oral tradition. Oral tradition, by definition, can be embellished. If I tell you a statement right now and you pass it around, by the time it gets to Andy over here, within 10 minutes, we probably have a different statement. We do this in parties called Chinese whispers. And you can see, if you have that kind of oral tradition that exists over 200 years, you can imagine how much embellishment there is. Yet there's no need for oral tradition after the 4th century. There's no reason why this should not have been written down immediately. Why does it have to wait for 200 years? Muslims will say, well, they are an oral society. That may be so, but within 10 years of Muhammad's death, by the time 641 rolls around, Basra, Baghdad, Damascus, Jerusalem, and Cairo were under their jurisdiction. These were all very literate cities, well-known metropolises with libraries in them. We know that Alexandria had a library in the 5th century that was destroyed. And certainly the Muslims who were then now controlled these cities were literate because, as we're going to see tomorrow, even the Muslims claimed that the Quran had been written down almost within 20 years of Muhammad's death. In fact, within 2 years of Muhammad's death, under Abu Bakr, it was first written down. So who was writing it down? We know the names of the men who wrote it down. Men like Zayd ibn Thabit, Ubla ibn Wad, ibn Mas'ud, ibn Musa. Who are these fellows? These are all scribes. These are all secretaries. They certainly could write. There's no reason why we have to wait 200 years for this to be written down. Storytellers. And this is where Crone really focuses a lot of her material. She says, if you look back, you will see it is the Kusas who are responsible for all this tradition. When you look and see, they have certain themes, stories, motifs that are combined and recombined. New details are added to it. You can almost follow it down from century to century so that by the time Ibn Ishaq and Waqidi take these stories, you will find that they relied on the same repertoire, the same motifs, themes. And that's why so many of them are familiar and so many of them are similar. Now, what's the conclusions? Well, the revisionist's prime concern was to look at that classical model that started from 570 and ended in 632. They wanted to look at that life of the Prophet and ask, can we really accept it? And their conclusion is that Islam and the Prophet's life, as we know it, was not derived from the 7th century, but evolved over a period of 200 to 300 years, as we've been mentioning. Now, what about the historical difficulties? Since the classical model is written so late, based on oral tradition, it became imperative for the modern historian to return to the time of the Prophet and find what those who knew him or lived in and around his locale knew of his environment. It is to this time and place that we now turn. Let's do that real quickly. I don't have time to get into all of it. The paper that's 80 pages long, it'll be up on the internet. You can pull it down. It'll be in PDF, right? So if you're Mac or not, you can certainly read it. But it'll be up there if you want to go through it. Lots of material you can look at, looking at much of this. But let me just give you a quick snapshot of what we're finding. According to the Quran, in Surah 2, Ayah 149, 5 to 150, start with 144 and go right to 150, you will find the reference to the Jews and the fact that at the very beginning of his movement, when he moved up there during the Hijrah in 622, for the first 2 years, his relationship with the Jews was a good relationship. He allied himself with the Jews, but in 2 years, that relationship deteriorated, so much so that he then became hostile to the Jews by 624. That relationship was completely severed, certainly by 627, when he basically killed 800 of the Banu Qurayza family, slit their throats of all the men in one afternoon after the Battle of the Trenches. Yet we get the Doctrine Iacobi, which is in the British Museum, written around 634 to 640, so you're talking quite a bit later, a good 6 years after Muhammad's death, 6 to 8 years after Muhammad, 2 to 8 years after Muhammad's death, which warns the Greek Christians and the Jews it warns the Greek Christians about Jews who mix with the Arabs. And then the Armenian Chronicle, which talks about Muhammad, who established a community which comprised both Ishmaelites and Jews. So the break occurred between the Jews and the Arabs looks around 640 after the Jerusalem conquest, 15 years later than the Quran is recorded. There are other references that talk about this relationship between the Jews and the Arabs, this good relationship which continued on beyond 640. We find this in the Genesis Rabbah, the Babylonian Talmud, Book of Jubilees, and the other ones you can see listed there. The Qibla is also a very damaging piece of material that's coming to light. Remember I said in Surah 2, Ayah 144 up to 150, it talks about the fact that the Jews, not only that relationship with the Jews was impaired, but also it refers to the changing the Qibla. Once the Jews no longer supported the Prophet, then a new revelation came down in Surah 2 that the Prophet was to change the Qibla, which is the direction of prayer from Jerusalem down to Mecca. And that happened, according to exegetes, around 624. 2 years after his movement to Medina. So from 624, the Qibla was then canonized to Mecca, which means that any mosque that is found after 624, and that means every mosque, because there were no mosques before 624, because he had not left Medina yet, he had not conquered beyond that, Islam had not really pushed its borders out of that. All that happened after 638, 641, and then up until the end of the 7th century. So certainly any mosque that should be found should have a Qibla facing towards Jerusalem. Dr. Fehrabadi and Dr. Kreswell are the two archaeologists who've done the most of the standard work on early Islamic architecture. And they have gone back in 1905, when they were able to get into these areas, they were able to go to Iraq, what is Iraq today, and they went to the Wasit Mosque, this mosque here, which is considered to be the oldest mosque that we've been able to get our hands on, built around 660. They went to the Kufa Mosque, which was built in 680. So these are long after 624, obviously. Therefore, they should be, though they are Islamic, they're two of the earliest mosques that we can look at. And when they dug down to the original floor plans of these mosques, because these have been destroyed and rebuilt a number of times, when they went to the original floor plans, they found the mihrab, they found the qibla in these mosques, and both of these mosques, though they're in Iraq, are facing west. They're off by 30 to 33 degrees. They should be facing southwest towards Mecca, if they're that late. They also went to Fustat, which is just out of Cairo. It's outside of Cairo. Here's the Kufa, just south of Baghdad. Wasit is just between Baghdad and Kufa. And those qiblas are facing west. They went to Fustat outside of Cairo, and they dug down to that original floor plan, and they found that it's facing east. But they should have been facing down here towards Mecca. And they said, this is a curious, and they just left it there. Now, obviously, it's more than curious because the revisionists are saying, archaeologically speaking, this seems to support what the documents are telling us. Jacob of Edessa in 705, a Christian writer, was traveling in Alexandria and also in Egypt at that time, and he refers to the Magrai, mentions them as Magrai, which is another name for the Saracens of that time, saying, from this it is clear that it is not to the south that the Jews and the Magrai here in the regions of Syria pray, but towards Jerusalem or the Kaaba, the patriarchal places of their races. No one understood what Jacob of Edessa was saying in 705 until they came across this archaeological evidence, which seemed to support the documentary evidence that there seemed to be a canonization of the Qibla towards Jerusalem and not certainly towards Mecca as late as 705. Now, we also know that the governor under Malik, Abdul al-Malik, there it is right there. The governor under Abdul al-Malik, and I'm trying to think of al-Hajjaj, the governor under al-Malik is responsible for having all the mosques destroyed and rebuilt in 705. Why would you destroy and rebuild mosques on such a grand scale in a time period, 705? Why do you think? Unless you're trying to redirect a Qibla. Now, what is in Jerusalem that they may be directed towards? Well, we have the Dome of the Rock, built in 691, the third most holy shrine in Islam. When you go to the Dome of the Rock, and I don't know if any of you have gone there, you will notice there is no Qibla on this structure. There should be a Qibla there. If it's that important, why is there no Qibla? Go ahead. Are you willing to say that publicly? I've said that publicly, and I've been massacred by Muslims. They don't like that, because obviously there's a problem here. If this is the Qibla as late as 705, then what are you going to do with Mecca? What we have found is when you go to the Qibla, now the Muslims will try to say that there is reference to the Qibla on the southern portico, which is just on this side over here. There is reference to Surah 2, Ayah 145 that I was mentioning earlier. And if you go up on the drum, up here along the top of the drum, there's reference to Surah 17, Ayah 1. I did a debate in London back in 1998, and this was brought to my attention. And most of the Muslims started yelling, Allahu Akbar, at the top of their voices. And you can hear it in the debate when he made that claim, saying, Mr. Smith, you haven't done your homework. And I said, hold on, stop and think. Do you think this is the original structure? This is not the original structure. This building has been destroyed and rebuilt 11 times. In fact, this building that you're looking at right now and that entire drum was built in 1876. Surah 17, Ayah 1 was built in 1876. Surah 2, Ayah 145 was put on 2 years later. It's very recent. And the reason why it was put on in 1876 is because of the same question I'm asking. Why isn't the Qibla there? You can see the problem. You cannot have something as important as the Dome of the Rock, the third most holy shrine, in the middle of Jerusalem without any Qibla facing towards Mecca, unless possibly it was the sanctuary, which could be the reason why the Wasit Mosque and the Kufa Mosque and the Fustat Mosque are all facing in the same direction, but from opposite ends. Could be. We're not going to say it is yet. We need to do more research on it. But that's fascinating, because when you look at this, it doesn't have a Qibla for a good reason. It's built in an octagonal shape. You build an octagonal building for circumambulation. It seems that maybe this could have been the original sanctuary. Now, we'll get back to that. If you look at the inner ambulatory of the inside the Dome of the Rock, you will see that this is the only part of the dome that is actually original. This is the only part that has been retained since 691. But it has no Qibla. The inner ambulatories have Quranic inscriptions on them, and it's interesting, we find that on those inscriptions, the very same thing that Andy found when they're now looking at all the references to the biblical Jesus, and that is, When you look at the inscriptions, they're all polemical. They're anti-Christian polemics. Almost uniquely, there's no reference at all on those inscriptions about why the building was built. Because Muslims will tell you today the reason it was built is to commemorate the Miraj, the movement of Muhammad up the seven heavens to meet with God and receive the five prayers. None of that is referred to on any of the inscriptions. And this is the only original part of the building that still remains. And what's most interesting is when you look at those inscriptions, they are Quranic, but they don't parallel the Quran that we have today. There are phrases and words that are distinctly different from the Quran that we have today, showing that even the Quranic verses have gone through an evolution. Dr. Patricia Quran decided, well, then, if this is so, then let's go back to Qibla. Let's go back to Mecca, and let's ask about the Hijrah. The Hijrah, which is the movement, the exodus from Mecca to Medina. And she found 56 references to the Hijrah, but none of them refer to the city of Mecca or a movement from a city of Mecca to Medina. There's no reference to that. What she found over and over again is a movement from the Hijaz, the central part of Arabia, up to the north, many times to Palestine, sometimes to Ctesiphon, which is the city that is now Baghdad, sometimes as far as Azerbaijan. But no reference between two cities of Mecca and Medina. She said, this is curious. Why has no one noticed this? What's more, she said, let's go back to Mecca and let's see what we know about Mecca. So what we do know about the Mecca is that it is the center of Islam, the center of history. It's the center where, according to what Keith said yesterday, is where Abraham and Ishmael went to rebuild the Kaaba. The first sanctuary according to mankind, according to Surah 396. It is the mother of all settlements, according to Surah 6, 92 and 42.5. Now, she said, well, if it's that important, then someone should have known about it. But she said, take a look at the map. This is the map from the 6th century. This is the time that Muhammad was, the 7th century, the time that Mecca would have been predominant when he was growing up there. And she looked at this trade route, this green line, which goes along the plateau of Western Arabia. She notices that it goes to Najran, Sana'a, comes up here to Taif. And after Taif, it goes down to Mecca. Can you see it makes a detour down there? Can you see the detour? Then it comes back up again to get to Yathrib, which is now Medina. We said, why has no one noticed that before? Mecca is not on the trade route. It's 1,000 feet off the trade route. If for a caravan to go from Taif to Yathrib, it'd have to go down 1,000 feet and come back up 1,000 feet. What's more, there's only one well in Mecca. It could not have accommodated the large caravans that was needed to do so. And then she said, well, if no one's asking this question, I'm going to ask it. So she wrote a book in 1987 called Meccan Trade and the Rise of Islam. And she looked at the claims the Muslims had made about Mecca. And she says, first and foremost, what Muslims have always told us for 1,400 years is that Mecca became rich because of 15 spices. So she took a chapter per spice in her book, and she asked the question, did these spices come from Mecca? She found that of the 15 spices, 13 of them didn't even exist in Arabia, and the two that did exist, frank and incense, were grown down here in the Hadramaut area, and they had nothing to do with Mecca. They didn't even know about a place called Mecca. So they decided to find out, well, where did the other spices come from? They all either came from India or from this part over here, Ethiopia. And what's more, she decided, when she looked at this map, that if all the trade was coming from India and China, and it was going to that part of the world, the Mediterranean, it would have to go up to the Persian Gulf. The problem was the Persian Gulf was closed down in the 5th and 6th century because of the battles between the Sassanid and the Byzantines. That closed down the Persian Gulf. Montgomery Watt came in and waded into the debate and says, well, that's another problem. Their trade was then redirected down to this part of the world, was transshipped off the ships here in Aden, and then went 1,250 miles all the way up to Gaza in the north. Patricia Caron looked at that map, and my 10-year-old son looked at that map, and my 10-year-old son could see a problem with it. Maybe you can see the problem. Can you pick it out? Say again?
Why go overland when you can go on the sea?
Exactly. Why go overland 1,250 miles when you've got a sea you can go up? Because what she found is if you take a ton of goods and you go 1,250 miles by sea, it's the same amount as only 50 miles by land. It would have been prohibitively expensive to take a 1,250 miles by land when you have a waterway going right up the west coast. She said, why has no one noticed before, and why haven't they not been questioning the classical records? So she decided to do so. Now, Patricia Crone speaks 15 languages. All of them archaic. She's a linguist. And so she went back to the original documents that no one had bothered to look at, including Montgomery Watt. She went back to the documents from this whole area. She went back to the Akkadian documents, the Syriac documents. She went back to the Arabic documents. She went back to the trading documents. She went back to the historians like Procopius, Cosmas, Theodoretus, who had been traveling all through this area. And she read their documents. She said, lo and behold, take a look and see. None of them talk about a place called Mecca. They don't talk about any overland trade. They all talk about a maritime trade. They all do talk about going up the Red Sea. And the name that comes up over and over again is this name, Adulis, which is the capital of Ethiopia. That's the name that controlled the trade. The Arabs had nothing to do with it because they were not seafarers. They were basically slaves on horses. They were nomadic. Why had nobody thought of this before? And why are people not questioning it? So therefore, she tried to find out any reference to the city of Mecca, anywhere. She couldn't find anybody that knew about the city. Not one reference. In any of the trading documents, no reference in the historians. Even the traders, she found documents that were written up here in Ctesiphon, which is now Baghdad today, where the Sassanids, who at that time came down all the way to Yathrib and built silver mines, or created silver mines here in Yathrib, right next to Mecca. They didn't even know that place existed. There's no reference to any place called Mecca.
What's the first reference?
Right here. The Apocalypse of Pseudo-Methodius in the Continuata Byzantia Arabica, written in 724. Muhammad died in 632. It takes almost 100 years to find the first reference to the city of Mecca. Now, why have Muslims not talked about this, and why are they not dealing with this problem? Can you see, if you don't have any historical reference to the city of Mecca, which is considered to be the oldest of all cities, remember the Muslims believe that when Adam and Eve were thrown out of the Garden of Eden, they were thrown down to Mecca. That's a pretty old city. Ishmael and Abraham went to Mecca in the 1900 BC to rebuild the Kaaba. That's a pretty old city. If it was a center of trade, north, south, east, and west, why is it nobody seems to know about it until 724, until the 8th century? Now, these are historical claims that need to be dealt with. Someone's got to take the Muslims to boot on this, and we're starting to do that. She then went back, and she also went found the reference to people called Muslims or Islam. If Jesus was a Muslim, then why is it there's no reference in any documentation at all for the word Muslim? What she found was the word Maghratai, Maghrai, which is the area of that part of the world, Hagarin and Ishmaelite. That was found over and over again because the Arabs consider themselves to be in the line of Ishmael through Hagar. That would make sense. And the word Muhajirun, which is the earliest reference we have for Arabs calling themselves Muhajirun, which means, if you split it up, people of the Hajarun, plural, people of the Exodus. The warriors that supposedly went with Muhammad when he went up to Medina. Those who took part in the Hijrah. Islam does not appear until the first reference we find to Islam is not till the late 7th century. In the sense of submission to God. Now, of course, it's peace. Yehuda Neva, out of the University of Jerusalem, decided to go back and look at a lot of the inscriptions, the earliest inscriptions we could find from the 7th century. He caught hundreds of inscriptions, found in the Negev Desert, out in Syria, down as far as the Hadramat, went to Taif, that town just southeast of Mecca, and found an inscription on a dam there. And he found these Arabic inscriptions written in the mid to late 7th century. So see, these should have been written by the earliest Muslims. During the Sufyani period, from the time of 660 up until 685. These inscriptions were therefore should have been written by Muslims, yet they have no reference to Muhammad, or a reference to a book called the Quran, or a reference to people called Muslims, or a religion called Islam. No reference at all in any of these inscriptions. It's not till 691, when he looks on the caliphal protocols of the Sufyani and the Marwanid period, the Marwanids came into power in 685, during the Umayyad dynasty. It's the Marwanids who then initiate what we call the Muhammadan formula. There's no reference at all to Muhammad as a universal prophet until 691. And it's on not only in the protocols, but it's on the coins that were coined at that time. We need to keep going because I think I'm going to run out of time. So what are the conclusions? Let's go. Hijrah was more than likely not towards Medina, but towards Palestine or the places in the north. The Qibla was not fixed towards Mecca until the 8th century, but to an area much further north and possibly Jerusalem. And that the Jews still retained a relationship with the Arabs at least until 640. Also, we find out that Mecca was not only unknown as a viable city until the end of the 7th century, but was not even on the international trade route. The Dome of the Rock was likely used as initial sanctuary. Muhammad was not known as God's universal prophet until the late 7th century, and the terms Muslim, Islam were not used until the end of the 7th century. Terms used instead were Sarasan, Maghre, Muhajirun, Hagarin. The five daily prayers we mentioned yesterday, as well as the Hajj, were not standardized until after 717 AD. Remember, Muhammad died in 632 and not named until the 9th century. It takes us till Bukhari that we finally find the five names for the references to the five prayers. The Fajr, the Isbar, the Tisbar, and the Issa. Now let's go on. The earliest we even hear of any Quran is not until the late 7th century, though fragments exist as late as the 7th century. And the earliest Quranic writings do not coincide exactly with the extant Quranic text. We're going to talk about that tomorrow when Keith and I go into that. So, is Muhammad a prophet? Let's now change gears and let's look at internally now. That was external. We're going to zip through the internal critique of Muhammad. Muslim position is that he has a supernatural witness, references to the fact that he was opened up as a child. His heart was then washed by angels. That once when he went up to see a Coptic monk who came to visit him with his uncle, the monk saw a cloud that protected him. These are all from the traditions. Other than that, there is no supernatural witness for him. He was illiterate. Yet, how could an illiterate person create such a beautiful book as the Quran? We find that in Surah 7, 157 and Surah 62, 2, it uses the word illiterate, unlettered prophet, to an unlettered people. That he prophesied points to his prophethood. And the only prophecy you can find in the Quran is actually Surah 30, 1-4, which talks about the fact that the Byzantines, who had been defeated by the Sassanids, which did happen in 615, will be defeated. Well, they will then in turn defeat the Sassanids in a few years. And we know that that happened in 628. If a few years mean 15 years later, okay, possibly. But if that were the case, then George Bush would be a prophet. It's a 50-50 chance as to who's going to defeat who. And it happened back and forth, back and forth. Miracles point to his prophethood. There is a challenge in Surah 17 from the Jews saying, where are your miracles? And of course, his response was in Surah 2, Surah 6, and Surah 13 and 17 that he did not need to show any miracles because all the former prophets did miracles. No one believed them. Therefore, according to Surah 17, 15, and Surah 13, he was nothing more than a warner. And then in Surah 54, 1, there is reference, not specific, of him splitting the moon, which is the reason why we found out, those of us who were at the apologetics sermon, talk earlier, that many people, many Muslims believe that Armstrong, what's his first name? Neil Armstrong became a Muslim because when he went on the backside of the moon, they took that famous picture of there's a large valley in the backside of the moon that we never see because it's always on the outside of us. And when NASA took that picture, that was the reference point of Surah 54:1, that the moon had been split and then brought down on either side of a mountain in the 7th century, and nobody seemed to know about it or be warned about it or didn't disturb our weather. Fascinating. But certainly, Surah 54:1 would be the only reference to a possible miracle in the Quran of Muhammad's. That's the Muslim position. What's our position? Well, first of all, there are four things that we have always ask. There's a qualifying parts right through the scriptures about who a prophet is. First and most importantly is that a prophet must be born in the prophetic race. And we find this in Genesis 17 when Abraham asks God about his son Ishmael. God says, I will bless him, but my covenant is with Isaac. And then, I'm not saying surah, chapter 22. He says three times, bring your one and unique son, Isaac, over and over again. They've got the wrong race. Muhammad is not in the Isaac race. And what's interesting, in Surah 29, 27, it stipulates that the prophetic race does come through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Fascinating. It's right there in the Quran. But of course, for Muhammad, he comes in the Ishmael line. And if you look at all the 25 prophets in the Quran, they all come in the line of Isaac. None of them come in the line of Ishmael, except, obviously, Muhammad. A prophet must speak in the name of God. And this is the most troubling one. We use this all the time at Speaker's Corner. Where do you find the personal name for God, Yahweh, that Moses demanded before he went down to Egypt to take out the Israelites? Bring back the Israelites. What was the name that he was going to use so they would recognize him? God said, this is my name forever. Every prophet would use this. And we know in the Old Testament 6,283 times that is the personal name that God used to delineate himself to basically show that he was different than all the other prophets. That name you won't find in the Quran. You won't find in any of the traditions. You will never see it on the prophet's lips. A prophet's message must conform to the previous revelation. We don't even need to get into that. There's all kinds of contradictions between his revelation and what we see previously, even the one we've just been talking about, and that is, who was the one that Abraham sacrificed? And then a prophet's predictions must be verifiable, or he must perform a miracle to verify his authority. What are his predictions? We don't know, except that one in Surah 30, and possibly, certainly, we don't know of any miracle he did. He never claimed to do any miracle. Muslims today say the Quran would be his miracle. Was Muhammad a specific or prophet to the Arabs? These are all the reference that seem to stipulate that he was a prophet to the Arab people, and only the Arab people, in the Arab tug, with an Arab revelation. Only two reference do we find as a universal prophet. Was he a prophet to the Jews? You need to ask the Jews that. Certainly, what did he do with the Jews in Medina? Look and see what he did with the Banu Qaynuqa family, the Banu Nadir family, the Banu Qurayza family. He threw them out because they would not support him, because he did not fulfill those four criteria. And when he did not fulfill those criteria, he then took umbrage with, threw them out, and then, of course, the third tribe, the Banu Qurayza, he killed all their men in one afternoon, took their women as concubines and their children as slaves. Was Muhammad a prophet to the Christians? Surah 2, Surah 3, and Surah 5 seem to suggest not. Surah 5, 54 says, O ye who believe, take not the Jews and Christians for your friends and protectors they are, but friends and protectors to each other. And he amongst you that turns to them for friendship is of them. Verily, Allah guideth not a people unjust. Was Muhammad the seal of the prophets? Well, if he was the seal of prophets, Remember what Andy was saying. One of the problems we have when you look at Jesus and Muhammad, Andy was going and giving you the parallels between Jesus and Muhammad. What he didn't tell you is that Jesus did miracles in the Quran, in Surah 3, in Surah 19. You will see that Jesus made birds from clay, blew on them when they flew into the air. He brought dead people back to life. He healed the sick. He made blind see. That's all referred to in the Quran. And Surah 19 is more specific, especially verse 19. He is perfect. He is sinless. None of this Muhammad did, according to the Quran. So the parallels break down when you start even, when you look at the Quran, when you start looking at what Jesus did compared to Muhammad. We use that quite often when we do a comparative between Jesus and Muhammad on the ladder there. What about the other prophets? Muslims would like to believe today that they are sinless, but when you look at the Quran, every prophet sinned. And we've got a whole list on our paper of all the sins of the prophet. They all sinned. What about Muhammad? He had a concession to people. I won't get into the stories. We don't have enough time. But certainly the satanic verses in Surah 53 is probably one of the most damaging one. I don't want to get into the sexuality. You can read my paper. I stay away from it. Don't jump into it. I know some people love to do that. Stay away. Especially one about Aisha. Certainly he did marry at 53 years old. He did marry a girl who was only 7 and consummated that at 9 years of age. That is not considered pedophilia, certainly not at that time, nor would Muslims agree to that. But what you can ask is that a model for today? Is that a model for mankind today? And no. And that's the only time I'll ever use it in public. He elevated himself a number of times, but certainly did he sin? Whereas Jesus was sinless in Surah 19, Ayah 19, Muhammad had three times asked for forgiveness of sin. In Surah 48, 2, he not only talks about the sin he did in the past, but the sins he was yet to do. So over and over again, Muhammad had to ask for sin, forgiveness for sin in the Quran. Jesus never had to ask forgiveness for sin anywhere in the Quran or in the Bible. So was he the seal of the prophet? I leave that up to you. Were the prophecies concerning Muhammad true? Now here is the problem for the Muslims. They've got to find a prophecy for Muhammad in the scriptures. Why? Because according to Surah 7, 157 and Surah 61, 6, it stipulates that you will find them, this unlettered prophet who is talked about in the Torah and the Injil. So they've got to find it in Deuteronomy 18 is where they look to first of all. I don't know if any of you have been questioned by this. It's great. Open up Deuteronomy 18 and read it for them. Start with verse 15 and go all the way to verse 20. Don't just stop with verse 15. Go all the way to verse 20. Because what it says there twice, in verse 15 and verse 18, it says, "For you will, there will come after me a prophet like unto me," and they usually, Muslims usually stop right there. They don't read the rest of the verse. "Who is from amongst your brothers." Now Muslims, when you bring that to them, they say, well, Ishmael is from amongst his brothers. Then you need to go back to chapter 17, verse 50, where it specifies very clearly, when God says, "You will raise up a king, he is to be amongst your brother, a brother Israelite." It defines it right there in the previous chapter. Help the Muslims with that. But then read on to verse 20, because there it stipulates what you must do to a prophet who dares to speak not in my name, but uses another name. A prophet who comes and dares to speak not in my name, but uses another name, put him to death. Muslims don't like to read the whole context. Read all the way to verse 20 to help them out with that. The conclusion is, that prophet that is like unto him is not Muhammad, it's Jesus. Other predictions of the Old Testament, you will find that whenever someone uses a sword, that must be Muhammad in Psalm 45, Isaiah 63. The geographic location, Deuteronomy 33, Isaiah 63, Habakkuk 3, that this a prophet who comes from Teman in Arabia, that must therefore be referring to Muhammad, or has names that are similar, like Judah, which is a very similar of the comforting one, or in Haggai 2:7, which is the comforter, the comforted one, which if you take Muhammad's name and you get the derivative Muhammad, Ahmad, Ahmad, it means someone who is lovely or someone who is glorious. In Song of Solomon 5:16, usually is the one they love to go to first, which says, "His mouth is sweetness itself, he is altogether lovely, this is my lover, this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem." The word is Mahmud in Hebrew, altogether lovely is an adjectival phrase. They like to change it to Muhammad, because Ahmad does mean altogether lovely. So therefore, when you put it in there, you've changed that to, "His mouth is sweetness itself. He is Muhammad. This is my lover. This is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem." Did Muhammad ever go to Jerusalem? I don't know. I don't think so. There's nothing in his biography that he went there. But you cannot do that to the Hebrew. You cannot just take an adjectival phrase and slap in a proper noun. The reason why is because you already have a proper noun that accommodates it. Hemdan is the altogether lovely one. It is a proper noun. If the author had intended it, he could have done so. But what's more, if you're going to do it there, you're going to have to do it everywhere. On our paper, we've got 11 references in the Old Testament where Muhammad is used. And every time, if you're going to put Muhammad in there, look how ridiculous it becomes. Let's do it with 1 Kings 26. Yet I will send my servants to thee tomorrow about this time, and they shall search thy house and the houses of thy servants, and it shall be that whatever is Muhammad in thy eyes, they shall take it in their hand and carry it away. It becomes ridiculous. You can't do that to the Hebrew. When Muslims like to do it for this, they don't like to do it for there. You've got to be consistent all the way through. If you're going to take an adjective or phrase, be consistent and change it to a proper noun. Do it in the other place. It comes down to ridiculous. The other place they go to is John 14 and John 16, the Parakletos, where they try to change the vowels from P-A to 2-A, E-N-O to E-I-Y-O. You can't do this again to the Greek. They think you can because in the Arabic you don't have vowelization. They assume the same thing happens with Greek. You can put the vowels where you want to. When you go to Parakletos, it becomes the comforter. Ahmed is the comforter. Therefore, when Jesus is leaving, he's going to leave behind the comforter. And this is getting back to what Andy said earlier. Therefore, Jesus is there to basically introduce the comforter that's going to come, Muhammad. They love to go to this, but you can't do that to the Greek language, nor do you find any Greek manuscript that includes that word, let alone in John 14 or John 16. No Greek manuscript includes Parakletos. It's always Parakletos. That word doesn't exist in any of the manuscripts. Therefore, Muhammad could not be the Parakletos. Why? Well, we know who the Parakletos is. If you just look at the context, it's very simple. In verse 16, he will be with you forever. Is Muhammad with us forever? He will be the Spirit of Truth. Is Muhammad the Spirit of Truth? The world neither sees him nor knows him. Certainly we saw Muhammad. Certainly we knew him. Most importantly, he will be in you. Muhammad in me? And obviously, Acts 1, 4, 5 gives it away. It's the Holy Spirit. Well, it's right there. He will be the Spirit of Truth. Verse 17, if they just read the context, it's very simple. This is not Muhammad. This is the Holy Spirit that came 58 days later. Right, let's stop there. Andy, why don't you come up and let's take questions because we are running a little late.
About 10 minutes.
We have about 10 minutes. We'll try to answer as many as we can.
Let's just stick. Dig.
Okay. Gosh, we've gone through so much. Yes. I can do this one if you want. Basically, that would occur in the Sirah of Muhammad, the biography of Muhammad. That would be external to the Quran. Muslims would want to say there are verses in the Quran that belong to that context, but no, you couldn't read the Quran and go, "Oh, look, these are the Jews being murdered." There are, you know, so the Jews are admonished for unbelief, and there are curses and so on and so forth. And some of those Muslims would say they were revealed in that context, but to get that story, you would go to Muhammad's biography. Yes. Yes, absolutely. For think.
I don't believe it's historical at all.
No.
Get me right.
Yeah, exactly.
The first to say it's not historical. But there's two different ways of arguing. There's two different ways of arguing with Muslims. You either have to argue from within their traditions, or you have to argue as a historian. Now, I did the historical critique first, and I should have made a real cut. Now, it says now we're going to put that to one side, and now we're going to argue as if we accept the traditions. And we accept them as historical. Now let's go and argue from within it. You can do both ways. And sometimes maybe we should have done it the other way around. We should have started. I usually always start with the internal evidence first and then go to the historical. But because Andy had done with the historical, we went with that first. Tomorrow I'll be doing it with the Quran. I'll be looking at the Quran internally, and then I'll be looking at the Quran externally. You can do both that with the traditions and with the Quran.
I think the other thing, just to echo that, the reason those texts are significant for Muslims is that if you have looked at the Quran at all, you'll be aware it's quite a jumble, it's chaotic, and Muslims, although they wouldn't phrase it quite like that, have long recognised that. So to make sense of it in Orthodox Islam, what you are interested in finding out is what's known as the Asbab al-Nuzul, which is the context of revelation. And so you need the history, the biography of Muhammad, to tell you when each bit of the Quran was revealed. So hence the biography of Muhammad or the Hadith are vitally important. In Sunni Islam, they are elevated almost, but not quite, to the level of the Quran. Less so in Shia Islam, they have their own traditions. Yep. But you can't read the Quran without traditions.
Shias will not accept Bukhari or Hisham or Ibn Ishaq. They will only go back to Ali.
But they have their own set of problems. Anybody else? Yeah. What can we then know about Islam was the question. Well,
This is a whole area that people are not willing to go into. So what do we know? Patricia Corona and Dr. Michael Cook tried to do that in 1975 when they wrote Hagerism. And they have been vilified, and they've had death threats put against them and castigated by Orientalists as well. No one wants to touch that. No one wants to answer that question. We've got to do it. But again, what we need to do is we need to have 100 people doing doctorates in this area. There's so much yet to trowel out and to pull up. But the reason why very few people want to do it is because of the threat, the violence that will come up. Yet it's fascinating. Look how much material and evidence has gone into the historical Jesus. Why isn't the same amount of energy going into the historical Muhammad when there is an enormous amount of things that eradicates? But here's what I say. Isn't it fascinating what Andy was doing? Did you see how much the historical evidence supports Jesus of the first century, and the Quranic material of Jesus puts him into the 5th and 6th century for Jesus? Whereas when you look at the historical criteria on Muhammad, it wipes him out of the 7th century and puts him into the 9th century. And basically, it's what the 9th century people redacted back what they thought Muhammad was. So you can see the historical evidence destroys the credibility for one of the great foundations of Islam while giving authority to the credibility to the Jesus of the Bible. That's why history is on our side. This is the beauty of it.
I think just to echo that, the thing I would say that I've increasingly realized since getting involved in kind of New Testament scholarship is to go, actually, we tend to look back at liberal Protestantism of the past and think of it as a bad thing. I think actually it's done us ironically a favor. I think God has a great sense of humor that the questions it raised, it forced evangelicals to come to terms with these kind of questions and do good scholarship. Now, if you look at historical scholarship on Jesus, Third Quest scholarship, the majority of the key players are all evangelical Christians. I could run off a whole list of them who are at the cutting edge of their fields. In Islam, on the other hand, there has never been these kind of questions. There's never been the equivalence of the kind of liberal end of the spectrum asking difficult questions, using historical criticism. So things, I think,
you don't live very long.
You don't live very long. So things are very slow. So there's never been no kind of raising up of this from within Islam.
Give an example. In 1994,
when I was studying under Dr. Hotting at SOAS, when I was learning all this material, so that's about a good 11 years ago, I decided to take it down to Speaker's Corner to see how it would work. I got up on the ladder, and I was knocked. This is before I got on the ladder. I was knocked to the ground unconscious by the Muslims there. When Dr. Hotting heard that I was doing this, he came to me in the hallway there at SOAS, and he said, "Mr. Smith, please do not take this public. This is not for public consumption. The Muslims must not hear this." You can understand his dilemma. I was quoting him, but I was quoting all these other Orientalists. You can see he didn't want to have to debate this in public. He wanted to do the research, but he wanted it to be kept in ivory towers in that academic setting. He did not want to get it down to the streets. We are the only ones that can take it down to the street. The Orientalists are not going to do it. They will not, they dare not, they cannot. We can. That's why I say, if we had 100 people to start working on this, and we are starting to get it, but we can't tell you about that now.
The very related quick point on that before we take another question. The other really interesting example is John Wansborough, who Jay quoted, who is as a kind of leading revisionist. Written some of the most incredible stuff in this area. The impact of his work is still being unpacked. He got death threats because of the work he did, and he switched discipline and ended up his academic life researching trade languages in medieval Spain or somewhere. Wasted. An Arabist by training, spoke about 10 different languages, but basically was scared off by the threats. So
it's up there, yes.
It's up there, and Muslims are beginning to respond to it. The typical response is try and write the whole thing off and throw it out. I think some Muslims are, to be fair, beginning to realize there are questions that need to be answered. But it's a long way to go before we see serious engagement with it.
On this material in 1995 with Dr. Jamal Badawi out of Halifax, who's considered to be the authority on the Quran in the English-speaking language in the world today, has done over 350 videotape teachings on the Quran in the English language. Used and it debates all over the world. We went to Cambridge University at Trinity College, and for 3 hours, I did those ten conclusions. I went through those 10 conclusions that you saw on the screen. That was in 1995, and then we put up the debate site basically to put that paper up there so that people could read it. We asked him if he'd give us his paper. He could not answer one of those 10 claims. That was in 1995. I was to debate him again in 2000 in Atlanta, Georgia. The week before the debate, he flew off to Malaysia. He would not come and talk about it. I have not seen him since 1995. He has not given us a rebuttal to any of these claims yet. Can you see the dilemma? If their best historian in the English language for the Quran cannot answer these 10 claims, and these are just 10 of the earliest claims, there's many more that we could put up there. Can you see the dilemma for Muslims?
The reason is very simple. Where are they going to go to find their material? When you look at Hagerism, which is the story of the book that was put together by Crook and Crone, every page is only about 3 or 4 paragraphs. All the rest are footnotes. They footnote 2/3 of all of their book, sourcing everything they say. They're not confessing Christians. No, not at all.
Okay, we've probably got time for one more question. Yeah, go for it.
Is there any hypothesis as to what might have happened to cause the political events that clearly did happen after the whatever, Muhammad or whoever? There was massive, the conquest of the entire area. Is there any thought?
Yes, we are.
You go first, go.
It's going to take a long time. Can you ask me this after? Basically, what we're... I'll just give it a quick nutshell. If you remember that map that I had up there, the map of the Hejaz, and you also saw a map of Byzantine world and the Sassanid. The Byzantines up here, the Sassanids down here. If you look at that map, you will see that there were these two great empires who were warring at each other, but then you had these nomads in the desert. And the question that the Qurans and the Cooks and the Hottings are saying is, stop and think. Look at Islam today. Why is it such a sophisticated, intrinsic, civilized religion? Why is there so much sophistication there? How could that have come in a nomadic pagan environment? Because this suggests a very urban environment with the rules, laws, institutions. All of this comes from an urban environment, which you don't find in 7th century Arabia, and certainly not around Mecca. How could it have come out in just a 23-year period? The probability is it did not come from Arabia at all. Now, what they would suggest is the Arabs were in the desert. They were nomadic. They were slaves on horses. They were kept in place by the Lachmans and the Ghassanids, which are the two buffer states for Lachmans for the Sassanids, the Ghassanids for the Byzantines. But these wars that were going on, they basically denuded their treasuries. So these two buffer states no longer kept them in place. Once Muhammad died, whenever that date was, we do know that the Arabs did move out of the desert and started attacking, first of all, Ctesiphon, which became Baghdad. That was the first areas they attacked, and they conquered it within 638. That is historical. There's no doubt about that. And then they moved up and they started conquering these 5 cities. Within 4 years, all 5 of those cities, Basra, Baghdad, Damascus, Jerusalem, and Cairo, the great 5 cities of the Levant, all came under their jurisdiction, the Arabs' jurisdiction, within 10 years of Muhammad's death. The problem is, what do you do when you're a nomadic people, when you come into much more civilized, sophisticated environments? Well, you do what anybody does. The Visigoths did this in Europe, and the Mongols did it later on amongst Islam. You just start borrowing, right, left, and center. And what Patricia Crone is saying, when you take a look and see at Islam today, it is not unique. All of it can be traced back to look at the laws, the laws of fiqh, the 4 laws, Hanbali, Hanafi, the Shafi, the Maliki school. These are nothing unique. They're basically Sassanid and Roman law, borrowed from this, but not from the Hejaz. They would have had to been in these areas to borrow them. And they don't get written down to the 9th century. That means they'd had 100 years of borrowing and working through and deleting what they wanted to keep, what they did not want to keep. But the most important thing, and this is what's exciting, is the traditions, the whole Abrahamic traditions that come out of Jewish material. And what you're going to find out tomorrow is a lot of the material that's in the Quran can be traced back. We've been able to source it back. A good 70% of the Quran we can source back to basically 2 genres of literature. One is apocryphal writings, Jewish apocryphal writings, and the other is Christian sectarian writings. We're going to show you that tomorrow. We'll hold on to that. But now put it together, you can start seeing where the scenario came. All of it's been borrowed. But it didn't get borrowed in a 23-year period. It got borrowed over a 100 to 150-year period. And it stands to reason that once you borrow, you put a man, a prophet, you pray, you start him in Jerusalem, he can't live there, you put him down to Mecca, he's got to have a book. That's why the Quran was finally put together. But it did not come about in the 7th century. The first manuscripts we have don't appear to the 8th century. Once you got a man and a book, you then have to create traditions around him. You've got to create a story. Those stories don't get written down to the 9th and 10th century, including all his sayings. Once you start doing that, then the theology starts interplaying. And look at all the debates between Christianity and Islam from the 7th, 8th, and 9th. All of that helps the theology get put into place.
Great stuff. Well, more on that tomorrow. Can I encourage you, as I'm supposed to do, to take a feedback form and evaluation form, fill it in before you go. That'd be really helpful. If you want to take one and pass them around. And so if you've got any questions and you want more information, Jay's material and my material will be up there on the website from the end of next week, or you can catch either of us around the conference in the next few days and ask us difficult questions.